This hour, a wonderful teacher, a master teacher who will provide encouragement and advice to teachers at every level and will get everybody to appreciate the best teachers. Teachers will learn how to invigorate their teaching and survive the waves of school reform. Rafe Esquith is our guest this hour, author of Teach Like Your Hair's on Fire. His new book is Real Talk for Real Teachers, advice for teachers from rookies to veterans, no retreat, no surrender. He is a fifth grade teacher, room 56 at Hobart Elementary School in Los Angeles. He's the father of four, grandfather of two, and he has taught at the school for nearly 30 years. He is the only K-12 teacher to be awarded the President's National Medal of the Arts. A documentary, The Atticus Finch of Hobart Elementary, was made about the great Shakespeare program he has run for many years. We'll talk about that a little bit in case you haven't heard about it. All of his students appear in at least one full-length Shakespearean production each year. And the English actor Ian McKellen noted that some of his students were mouthing the words to a play in which he was performing in Los Angeles. He's been given Oprah Winfrey's Use Your Life Award, the Kennedy Center's Sondheim Inspirational Teacher Award, and many other awards. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and I would think we'll get many on this topic. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Rafe Esquith, thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for writing a new book.
No, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, our great pleasure. You write at one point in the book, and I don't think people fully realize this unless they teach, that teaching is an incredibly difficult job.
Oh, yeah.
Why?
Oh, there are so many reasons. But the reason I wrote Real Talk especially is it seems like good teaching is an endangered species, because every day you hear about these wonderful teachers who've had enough and they're giving up.
Yes.
And it's not because of difficult kids. We've always dealt with that. Or you know, difficult home situations. Teachers are giving up because for the first time in a long time, the system itself has become the teacher's enemy. And teachers are bitterly remarking at this point that those who can teach and those who can't make rules for teachers.
Mm.
And there are rules being made by people who couldn't teach our classes to save their life. And people are throwing up their hands in frustration. And I wrote Real Talk to try to bolster the spirits of my colleagues.
And indeed you do that, and then some. You write about the bad days and the good days. You say that really to become a truly outstanding teacher, as is true with so many other professions, that it doesn't happen right away. There are no great teachers who have been teaching for only 3 years, and that, yet there are a lot, I hear, of teachers who teach for 3 years and say that's enough.
It's true, and the first part of the book is addressed to those young teachers. I want them to understand. You know, unfortunately, sometimes they're in training programs where they hear you're going to save every kid, or they've watched the Hollywood movie where, you know, everybody wins the big game at the end. And I want to let them know that you read all those silly honors I've won. I'm good at what I do, and I fail all the time. And I have bad days all the time. And I want the young teachers, you know, in their second or third year to understand you're not necessarily a bad teacher. This is a tough job. We're trying to teach kids to be honorable in a world that isn't. And if they can stick with it and learn from their mistakes, you can become really good, and that's when teaching becomes tons of fun.
Mm-hmm.
But it does, you're exactly right. And in this fast food society, I want both teachers and students to know that true excellence takes many years of work and failure and learning from those mistakes.
One thing that people so admire about you and about good teachers is the amount of time that is put into this incredibly important profession. You write, and this is a tall order, Rafe. You have to be the person you want the kids to be. I'm always the last one to go home. They see how hard I work.
It's true that we are role models, but I want to make this really clear. There are great teachers who've got to leave at 3 o'clock. They've got kids to take care of. I raised four. But what I'm asking of teachers is, step one is you've got to be that role model. And, for example, I want my kids to be nice. Well, that means I've got to be nice, and I mean all the time. It doesn't mean I don't get mad at them. Kathleen, there are days I want to throw them out the window.
Right,
we've all been there.
Right.
But I always joke with teachers that if you're screaming at the children to be nice, that's a mixed message, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to constantly look at yourself because the kids are looking at you. And my kids do work hard because they see me work hard, and they are very calm because I really am calm with them. But it takes many years of practice to develop that smooth calm when everything's going crazy around you.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to say anything? A lot has been made of the fact that you work in a pretty tough school district. A lot of your students are on free breakfast and free lunch.
Sure.
Their home lives are not terrific. But you've been able to get great success from these students and get them to take charge of their own lives and their own education, which is no small task.
I think one of the key chapters in my book that's something that any teacher can do, there's a chapter called Keeping It Real, and there's a bit of language I use in the book that I hope, I already know many teachers think is a good idea. If you ask most kids in school, you know, why are you doing your math? Why are you writing that essay? The kid will say, because my teacher told me to,
right,
or it's assigned. If you ask one of my students why you're doing the math, the kid will say to you, if I learn this skill, my life just got better.
Mm-hmm.
And every lesson I teach, we talk about the skill we're working on and why we're working on it. It's not for the test at the end of the year. It's not to please Rafe. It's because it's going to help you. And if I can just give you a simple example, even when we play baseball, you could talk to my kids, what are you really working on here? And the kids will say, well, you got to concentrate to play baseball. You got to focus to throw and catch. And you also have to focus when you drive a car, if you're a surgeon or a barber or a gardener or a mechanic. To play baseball, you've got to work as a team. You can't win a baseball game by yourself. But people in business have to work on a team. People who are nurses have to work with a team. And this is the conversation I have with my students all day long. The reason my students work hard is they're not working for me. They're working for themselves. And that's the way I think we have to frame our relationship with the children.
So how do you frame it? You write about day one and then day two and then beyond. You say in room 56, the kids learn on the first day that the future is completely in their hands. How do they learn that?
Well, they don't learn it on the first day. They hear about it on the first day. But what I want teachers to know is when things go wrong on day one or day two, there's going to be a day 20 and a day 25. And the way the kids learn it is the message is very consistent. It's the same message all day long, all year long, and slowly, and sometimes painfully, the kids start to internalize this idea that what we're doing in this classroom is going to help me for the rest of my life. And the other thing, and this is something I really urge teachers who've been teaching 5 or 6 or 8 years to think about, is the best support you're going to get is from your former students. I have a chapter in my book called Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. And every day now, because I've been doing this for a long time, I have former students who return from high school and college who talk to my class and mentor the young ones. And my little kids listen to these mentors much sooner than they listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
These are kids from their streets who speak their language, who grew up in the same situation. So it gives them a vision of what their life could be. That's why they're listening. Not so much to me, but to the evidence of what a good teacher can produce.
You also include, and I can't remember the young student's name, but there have been instances where your students, sometimes those who are not very talkative, have taught you important lessons. There's a student who was a music prodigy. Can you tell her story?
This is so great. It's funny you brought that up, Kathleen, because I'm going to see her tonight. I'm speaking to you.
Oh, you are?
I'm speaking to you from Chicago. That's amazing.
Huh.
Many years ago, when I was still trying to find my voice, the kids and I were trying to work out something in music, and we have a tremendous music program now, but it wasn't all those years ago. And this little kid in the back of the room walked up to this terrible keyboard I had and played this song perfectly when we've all been struggling trying to make it work. And this was after months in the classroom. And we said, how did you do that? We asked her, how did you know this song? And we found out that this child who had said nothing all year long, and some of these kids had known since kindergarten, was one of the great pianists in California, a complete prodigy, with perfect pitch. She wound up winning the Fulbright Scholarship in Music. She's a PhD from Northwestern today. But the point of the story was, when I asked her, why didn't you say anything? She taught me that it really wasn't her place to show off her skills. And not only did it turn out that she was a musical prodigy, she was one of the top 10 swimmers in California. And no one knew this, not her closest friends. And I suddenly saw the beauty and the value of humility. So what I got from her is the kids that I work with now are extraordinary in what they do, but they're almost invisible. And I know that's not part of our popular culture now where everybody wants to, you know, show off all the time. But in our class, it's a quiet bunch. And some people have remarked, gee, they're so shy. They're not shy. They're just confident. And Joanne, the girl you talked about who is a PhD in music, now when we do our Shakespeare production, she scores all the music for us. And when she comes back and returns to L.A. to work with the kids, she's treated like a goddess. Mm. And the thing that's cool is I'm signing books in Chicago tonight, and she and her husband are going to be there, and she just had a baby. So I get to meet the baby tonight. And when people think teachers don't get rewarded enough, I think they're mistaken. There's nothing better than meeting her tonight with her husband and kid.
Oh, you're going to have such a great night. I'm so glad I asked about her. I had no idea that that was happening.
I'm sort of fond of her, Kathleen.
I guess you are. And it's too bad. You ought to be rewarded in many other ways, but that is an ultimate reward to have people come back to you so many years later and have such accomplished lives and realize the role that you played. And by golly, it's such a huge role when we think about it, Rafe, the importance of teachers, a particular teacher or a few teachers, if we're lucky in our life, who have really found a talent in us or discovered us or allowed us to find the talent in ourselves. And literally, and this is not overstating the story, changed our lives.
It's true. And one of the things that I wrote the book for is there are a lot of teachers who are changing lives and they don't even know it. It is a thankless job. And a lot of kids have better lives who never write letters, who maybe themselves don't understand that their life is better. And I want teachers to remember that they are making a difference. It's tough because when you open the paper, you always read the story about the horrible teacher or some terrible thing going on in the schools. And those stories are true. I don't deny them. But there's also amazing teaching going on in schools that you never hear about because, you know, we love to watch the train wreck. It's part of our culture. Mm-hmm. And since our society kind of treats teachers shabbily, I just thought one of their own better start speaking up for them. And that's why I wrote Real Talk.
We welcome phone calls, and let's go to them just momentarily here. Our guest is Rafe Esquith. He is the author. You probably read this book. It was very much noticed, Teach Like Your Hair's on Fire. His new book is Real Talk for Real Teachers, Advice for Teachers from Rookies to Veterans, No Retreat, No Surrender. He probably came to national attention because all of his students do a full Shakespeare production while they're in his class, and a lot of actors and Shakespearean actors have been just amazed by what goes on in the classroom. He really is a master teacher. He has been teaching for 30 years, and he writes about what goes on in his classroom, and it isn't all easy. He said, there are days when you fail. He's working with some children who he will never reach, but he's done this for nearly 30 years. Fifth grade teacher, room 56, Hobart Elementary School in Los Angeles. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. An email, talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. For those of you who have been teaching for a long time, we would really like to hear from you. For those of you who are starting in the profession and need some encouragement, or maybe you feel as though you've entered something that's just too hard and you're thinking of leaving, maybe he can talk you into staying if you care about what you do and you want to continue. We'll take your phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phone calls now for Rafe. Let's go to Joe in Stevens Point first. Hello, Joe.
Good day. Good day.
Good day to you, Joe.
How's everything? I just wanted to make a couple quick comments. First one, tomorrow creeps in this petty pace to the last syllable of recorded time. And as a theater person who got into acting, I have to say I'm so thrilled by anyone teaching at that level Shakespeare. It's truly fantastic.
Oh,
and number two, as a Wisconsinite, it's It's difficult because with the current environment and atmosphere here in the state, it seems like there is a lot of good teachers coming out.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality of this thing is we're going to have to kind of get beyond the partisan struggles to come up with really good education reform. And I'll take my answer off the call.
All right, Joe.
Joe, you raise really important issues. By the way, it's not just Wisconsin. It's not even just the United States. I've spoken all over the world. And I'm telling you, if you talk to teachers in China, you would think you were talking to teachers in Wisconsin. They're
really
dealing with the same problems. We think we're so different. We're not that different, believe me. I was just there. We were close friends within 30 minutes, just laughing about the craziness of the job. What my strategy has been, Joe, and I don't have all the answers, but I have a chapter in the new book called The Quiet Man. I know there are people who want to reform education, and I'm the first one to tell you we need reform. But meanwhile, what I'm thinking about is, if it's hard for us, imagine what it's like for the kids who walk into these classrooms where real learning has been replaced by rote memorization to simply regurgitate a bunch of facts back on a standardized test. That has nothing to do with education. So what I do is I go to all those meetings, and I listen to the bureaucrats talk, and I nod my head and smile. I never argue with them. And then I quietly go back to my classroom, do the curriculum they ask, but I add the good stuff, mm-hmm. which is what keeps my kids coming back. So I really think that a lot of battles on the school site can be won without firing a shot. And I see amazingly wonderful people fight desperately. And I get it. I understand the righteous anger. But if I'm using that energy arguing with people, that I think is taken away from my students.
You are who you are, and you're a best-selling author, and you do this nationally acclaimed Shakespeare program, and you've been teaching at a school for 30 years. For a teacher who has been in a school for 5 years and is getting a directive from a principal or from a superintendent or whatever, that they need to make sure that the scores on the standardized tests are higher.
Don't forget, Kathleen, I was there. When I first introduced the idea of Shakespeare and rock and roll, people thought I was insane.
I'll bet they did.
So the strategy I used was I did everything they asked of me, and I did it well. We did well on those tests. We prepared. We didn't make any trouble. And when they saw that I was a good teacher, they started to leave me alone.
Oh.
And that's the thing about, you know, this idea of the long-term plan. There's a quote at the beginning of my book from Michelle Rhee where she said, "You can't expect people to make a long-term commitment anymore. That's just not the reality." I understand what she's saying, but I disagree with it. I want the kids to know I am making a long-term commitment. We're asking the kids to commit to education. If they see their teachers leaving all the time, why would they commit?
Mm-hmm.
So I do understand that second and third year teacher. I would suggest don't make waves. Do what you're told to do. But have a long-term plan where, for example, I know a teacher, an amazing teacher who runs the marathon every year. And in about her 6 year of teaching, she started a marathon club. And several times a week after school, her kids train with her. And although she does the basic curriculum and does all the things she's asked of, her kids run the marathon every year. It's fantastic. And it brings them much closer together because of that shared experience and that passion that she's sharing with them. And that's what I'm suggesting. But of course I went through those years.
Yeah. Do you have time to do both, to do Shakespeare and to get good test scores?
I do. And the secret for me, and have a big family, don't forget.
I know, right.
My secret, by the way, is I just don't watch television. So when I hear people talking about all these people, and I have no idea what they're talking about. When I get home at 5:30 or 6 o'clock, I'm with my family. And I also point out in the book that as you get better at this, your early years where you're scrambling around trying to get the supplies that the school couldn't order and you're spending your nights desperately trying to grade papers, you get better at it. So now I spend a couple of hours a week planning and the rest of my time teaching and being with my family. So there are rewards for your hard work when you've paid your dues.
Yeah. Martha in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Martha.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Martha.
Hi, Race. I just want to say, first, I have read your book, Teach With Your Hair on Fire, Like Your Hair is on Fire. And I just want to thank you for standing up and saying what you said just a few minutes ago about, yes, there are teachers that aren't doing a very good job, but,
sure.
You know, we need to, we also need to celebrate those teachers who are, you know, doing their jobs.
Martha, I know. I work with them.
Inspiring students.
Mm-hmm. I work with them every day. You know, Martha, one of the things the press gets wrong, because I got known, they create me as this iconic figure, like I'm alone there. How do you think I get the Shakespeare play done? I've got like 10 teachers there who kill themselves for my class. I have a whole chapter in the book called All for One and One for All. And mm-hmm. one of the things that keeps me going is I've surrounded myself with terrific teachers who inspire, who laugh with me, sometimes cry with me. And my advice to young teachers, don't do this alone. There are wonderful people in the profession that you never hear about. And that's I don't think it's ever going to change. And that's why we've got to rely on each other, because we're the best support system we're going to have.
There are so many good people in the profession. And you write at one point here that you can become isolated. You can be in that little room with four walls and think, I'm doing this all by myself, and it's
You're
so hard.
Alone. And for the young teachers who are having their bad days, if you go to a good teacher and tell them where you think you're failing, they won't think less of you. They'll think more of you because you're honest.
Mm-hmm.
When the young teachers come to me, and this happens occasionally, somebody visits me and they say, well, I've got it perfect. Nothing ever goes wrong. I'm just the best teacher ever. I just laugh to myself, and I know they're not. Nobody's that good. I'm not that good. I mean, in this book, I write constantly about my many failures because it's true. And I've told people, even with the best medical care, people die in hospitals every day.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody saves everybody, but it's our job to try to get to every kid we can and give them an opportunity to be the best they can be.
I would have to say, Rafe, though, I think you're a very good teacher.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I think you are. Martha, thank you. Reed in Clintonville, hi.
Yeah, yes. Good afternoon, and thanks for this opportunity, and thanks for having the gentleman on.
Hey, Reed.
First, let me thank him for his comments early on in the show concerning the fact that those that teach can, and those that can't are those that make the rules for the rest of us. With about 37 years of teaching behind me, I still see students that say, I enjoyed your classes so much. I've even on occasion had a student say, you're the best teacher I ever had, which I think is going a little beyond. But I want to make two comments. One is our teachers are leaving the profession not only because of the heavy-handed rules that are being placed upon teachers across our state and the nation, but also because they cannot afford to stay in the profession.
It's a fact.
That's the first comment. And the second comment is I find it so unusual and unique that we have a man at the head of government in the state of Wisconsin without a college education who seems to think that he has the ability to direct what is done here in the state educationally. And it just flies in the face of high-quality education for him to say something of that and directives that he has given us.
Well, it's not just Wisconsin. It's really all over the country, Rafe, isn't it? There are all kinds of politicians who want to tell people how to teach, how to run their classrooms.
One of my favorite writers that I quote all the time is George Orwell. And I've given up on systems. I don't care. You know, the Who's great line, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Every 5 years, guys like Reed and me sit in meetings, and now it's the Common Core that's going to save education, this new curriculum. And, of course, it's not new. You know, no matter what you teach, 3 times 5 is still 15. You still have to put a period at the end of the sentence. The presentation of your papers is important in the mm-hmm. way you turn them in neatly. These are all just basic facts. So I steal my resolve by working with my former students and working with my colleagues. And I don't worry about if the politicians will get it, because I know they won't.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's wasted energy. And what makes me feel terrible is a guy like Reed, this guy gave 37 years.
Right.
We need the new teachers to meet him and to see what you can do in 37 years. People ask me, why don't I become a principal? Or, you know, start my own school. And why would I leave Room 56? I've got the best job in the world.
Oh.
I walk by my principal's office every day, and I work for a really good principal. And I see his blood pressure medication and the Tylenol on his desk and parents screaming at him. I'm not crazy. I would never want a job like that.
He talked about the money, and your wife would like a new kitchen, and it sounds like she's never going to get it, right?
Reed should hear this, but when my book opens, my wife Barbara wants a new kitchen, and we figured out how much money I make. And if I can teach for about 470 more years...
Ooh.
She can have the new kitchen. So it's going to happen, but I just got to put 470 more in.
Yeah. But what do you think about Reed's underlying thoughts here concerning the teachers not really being at the table when it comes to education reform, when it comes to determining what's going to happen in the classroom, in determining what best educational practices may be? It seems to me as though they are being ignored, and it's troublesome not only to the teachers but to a lot of people. Aren't those the people you go to help fashion policy so students can learn?
You would think. I mean, I know as a teacher, anytime I'm in trouble, I go to an expert. For our plays, I need a choreographer. I don't know anything about dancing, so I go to an expert. And the fact that people don't go to the teachers is one of the reasons I wrote this book. I hope one of the things I did in the book is that at the end of every chapter, there are talking points. And it's not that everybody's going to agree with them, but I'm hoping it stimulates real discussion about the issues that Reed was talking about and all teachers are talking about, of that this job has become literally impossible to do. And you shouldn't have to be Superman or you know, a superhero to teach a class of students. And let's also not forget another issue, which is we're working with kids that are growing up in a society which believes that the Kardashians are more important than people curing cancer.
Oh, I know. Can we just...
That's a tough... You know, I'm in Los Angeles, where Kobe Bryant is a hero.
Right.
And, you know, Kobe Bryant is a phenomenal basketball player, but he's not a hero. Even his own teammates don't want to play with him.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of conversations I have with my students.
Isn't it weird how we reached a point in society where people write about the Kardashians? Who the heck cares about them? I don't get it.
I can't. Believe me, I just shake my head and disbelief.
I do too. I just don't get it.
But it's important to have these conversations with young people. Because if we don't have them, nobody's having them with them.
Right, yeah. Thanks, Reed, so much for your call. Courtney in Racine. Hi, Courtney.
Good morning.
Hi, Courtney.
Good afternoon. I'm so excited to hear Rafe because just yesterday I was on Facebook and a friend of mine had posted that the book was coming out in the Washington Post little snippet. And as I was reading through, I was like, yes, yes, yes. These are all the things I see. I'm a teacher. And I teach fourth grade, and I was getting so excited because, you know, we're into the summer, like, cool down of gathering our strength back up for fall.
How many years, Courtney?
I'm just, 10th year, 4th district.
Oh, my gosh.
Mm.
So we've moved a little bit. I've taught in southern Wisconsin, Kentucky, and northern Wisconsin. So I have lots of different experience from different different districts that I bring to this district, and I'm loving it. I love my job. I love my kids. And I was actually meeting with my principal today, and I was showing her the blurb on the Washington Post. I'm like, we need to get this book for our staff. And I'm just so excited to hear you. Because
you know, it's funny. People tell me about things. I never read the paper. I have no idea what people are saying. But I do.
Well,
I am hoping.
I'm glad you said it.
I really am hoping. I did write this book for staff development because if you've ever gone to those meetings, they're pretty bad.
They're horrible.
You know, there's a joke I wrote in another book. This is terrible, but I had a friend, a dear friend, who was dying of cancer. And our meetings were Tuesday, and his chemotherapy was Tuesday night. And he said that he looked forward to the chemotherapy because the worst was over.
Oh, no.
I'm hoping this book... Go ahead, Courtney.
When I read in your book, it just the love that you have for your kids just shines through. And I feel like some teachers who get into this, they come into it as a job. And I feel like we need to see it as this is an extension of our family, and we need to love these kids and meet them where they're at. And if they don't love us back, we've got nothing on them. And I teach at a high poverty school. I think we're at 97% poverty. So we're, you know, free and reduced breakfast, lunch, you know, everything. And we have similar circumstances, I'm sure, as you have at your school. And these kids just need to know that we care about them and that we love them.
I love the way you said family. One of the interesting things, I'm very in demand in China right now, and they're struggling over there. And one of the questions you always get asked in China that I've been trying to show them is, a Chinese teacher will say, I teach math, or I teach fifth grade, or I teach high school. And I'm trying to get them to say, I teach students, to think of them as and respect them as human beings. And the Chinese always ask me, well, we know you have your family. How did you raise your children differently than your students? And I tell them there is no difference. Absolutely none. My own kids read the same books I read with my class. They hear the same values. I'm the same person all the time. It's not that I'm perfect, but that stability develops the kids a confidence in their teacher and a trust where they're willing to listen to the lessons because they trust you instead of fear you.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact that you use the word family because it's an important word.
Mm. Yeah, you say that in the book, and I think that's important. It sounds like a simple thing, but it's not.
No, it's not simple.
No, and you try to be in the same mood every day so that you're dependable. People don't have to worry, you know, is he down today? Is he mad today? What's his mood? That you're steady.
I do a thing in my car every day when I pull up in the parking lot. You know, you can call it a prayer or whatever, but I do take a couple of minutes that if I've had a bad day, or like a couple of years ago, I had a daughter who was having a difficult pregnancy and I was worried about her. But when I get out of that car, it has to stay in the car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my kids have enough problems. They don't need my problems. And I really do try and stay positive. And the word family, the great American playwright Sam Shepard was once asked, you're always writing about family, always family. Why do you always write about family? And Sam Shepard replied, well, what else is there? That was a great response.
It is a great response. Courtney, all the best to you. Thanks so much for your call. Terry in Oconomowoc. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Ray. Huge
Hello.
Fan. Love your work.
Thank you.
The documentary was incredible, and your work is having a huge influence on teachers all over the country. Thanks for standing up. We really need you now. I've been teaching for, it's going to be my 23rd year coming up.
Oh, a hero's on
every
the phone.
Day of it.
God.
And I love how your focus is not on the system or the politics. It's just on the kids, and I think the powers that be could learn a lot from you. My question was from the movie Waiting for Superman, which, you know, got mixed reviews, and
sure.
Everybody has an opinion on it. But I thought they brought up a really great question. I know that you teach in a really tough neighborhood.
Yeah.
And that was, is a school failing because it's in a failing community, or is a community failing because it has a failing school?
Yeah. No, I mean, for me, it is about the community and the difficulties in overcoming that. I have a chapter in this new book called There's No Place Like Home. And I am getting tired of reading that as the teacher, you are the number one factor in a child's development. That's not true. Their family comes first always. Even when they say, well, at least during the school day, you have the biggest effect. I still don't think that's true because, most of the parents I work with are wonderful, but there are some parents who have so many issues, whether it's substance abuse or fighting at the home, where you're getting a kid in your classroom who is not prepared to be a good student. That's not his fault, and I don't think we can give up on that kid. That's why I've been there for 30 years. But the community is failing for a different reason, I think, and that's poverty. And that's something that isn't discussed enough.
Mm-hmm.
I had a wonderful kid this year, and I had a lot of success with him. But he has a father who's not in the home. His mom is working a graveyard shift. I used to take him home sometimes. And when he comes home at 4 and 5 o'clock, no one is there, and she's not there all night long. You know, he wakes up in the morning and sees her for a couple of minutes. That's the only time he sees his mom.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course this kid is not going to be in the same position as a kid growing up on the nice side of L.A. with two parents who went to Stanford. It's a fact. And, of course, we have to do everything we can for this child. But for us to simply say, well, you know, it's always the teacher's fault. It's always the school's fault. It's much more complicated than that. And we can never give up on this child, but I think especially the young teachers have to understand that that is part of the reality, and that when that kid isn't listening, or he comes in because he's sleep-deprived, or he hasn't had dinner the night before, which happens in my classroom all the time, you have to factor that in when you're deciding if you've been successful or not.
Right. And sometimes you're not going to reach all the children.
Absolutely not. Nobody does.
Right.
Except in the Hollywood movies.
Right. Yeah, how true. Terry, thank you so much. Unless you had something else, sir.
Oh, no, thank you. That's great. Thanks,
Thanks, Terry.
Thanks, Terry. Deborah in Brown Deer. Hi.
Hi. I just love everything you've said. Every little word out of your mouth.
thank you.
I think joint custody is going to be is a factor in all of this, and I've tried to point it out. I mentioned it in my own situation, but to teachers that my son has had. But I just want to tell you this. I was looking for schools in the Milwaukee Public School District when my son was about to go into kindergarten, and I visited four different schools, and the one I liked was a teacher that I liked,
mm-hmm.
and she was going to be taking a year off for because she was pregnant, but
okay.
And one of the schools was space-oriented, and they had a mobile planetarium. And then when I walked in the doors, they had gun detectors, and so that eliminated that. And then I asked my neighbor in Brown Deer, Ann Griffin. I want to give her a shout out. I don't know if she's listening, but she's just really heavily invested in helping kids in the education process, although she's not a teacher. And I said, "What do you think would be a good school?" And she said, and I quote, "Any school can be a good school. It's the parents that matter."
Yep.
And with all the joint custody, there is, I haven't heard it mentioned enough. And I think, you know, a kid spends half the time with his dad, half the time with his mom. I'd find a backpack full of German homework in my son's backpack, and I'd make him sit there. I don't care how, you know, for the whole weekend. Yeah, he'd complain he had to stay inside, but I'd make him finish it because, and then maybe he didn't get credit for it, but he'd have to finish it. And so I think joint custody is a big issue.
Is it
good?
You think that's an issue, Rafe?
Of course it's an issue.
Right.
They're all issues. The one thing I worry about with some, not all, most teachers still understand this. You know, you do get difficult kids. I mean, I've had some kids. I wrote about a kid in the book who within 5 seconds of my classroom punched out the girl next to him and told me to go F myself. You know, and you know, these kids use language I didn't know till I was 15 years old.
Right.
And you want to say, oh, the heck with it, I give up. But you can't give up on that kid. He's still a kid.
Yeah.
And he didn't learn that from his fourth grade teacher.
Mm-hmm.
This is his home situation. Mm-hmm. What I try and do is simply show them calmly there is an alternative way to live your life. You may not buy what I'm selling, but I'm going to introduce you to people who are trying to live the lessons I teach them, and they're doing really well. And I believe that you can do this too. But you've got to be really patient. It takes a long time, sometimes years,
mm-hmm.
till you see those messages sink in. And, you know, the teachers who are listening know this. You go to these meetings and they have, you know, they have these calendars up where they go like, you know, on April 10th, all the kids are going to know this particular skill. And it looks great on the calendar, but that's not real life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why this book is called Real Talk for Real Teachers. I'm trying to inject a dose of reality into the conversation.
And you mentioned some of the tough situations you've encountered. I don't think that most people realize what teachers encounter. There's another story. The book isn't loaded with them, but they really stand out. The young guy who you were doing some kind of project and painting things, and he takes the paintbrush and starts eating the paint off the paintbrush. His mom comes to school and says, "You took away my son's paintbrush."
The funniest thing, for the people who are listening, I had a kid eat a paintbrush full of paint. And I'd never had that happen in 25 years. And when I took the brush away from him and said, "You're not going to get to do the project today," his mother came in the next day. And what was hilarious was I had a group of young high school kids who were considering being teachers.
Oh, no.
And they were visiting that day, and they saw this mom come in and scream at me in language worse than a sailor. And by 30 minutes later, all of them had decided not to become teachers.
Oh, no.
It was hysterical. But you know what? Here's the point of the story, though. That boy, it was a tough year because the mother was always screaming at me and complaining, but he actually did okay. He actually had his best year of school. He and I are not close today. He doesn't visit. But I've heard that he's still doing okay in middle school. So, you know, scars and all, he's doing a little better. And that's something. That's some of the solace a teacher can take.
That is something. Sometimes something is okay. Rafe Esquith is our guest. His new book, Real Talk for Real Teachers, Advice for Teachers from Rookies to Veterans, No Retreat, No Surrender. If you're not familiar with his work, he's well worth learning about. He's taught at Hobart Elementary School in L.A. for 28 years. He is the only teacher to have been awarded all kinds of awards, but he's a master teacher, and the book is inspirational for those who are teachers and for those who blast teachers. It gives you an understanding of the complexity of the work and of the profession and the importance of the profession as well. He's the guy, you probably are familiar with this part of his work, who has all of his students, fifth grade students, perform whole plays. We're not just talking a soliloquy, whole Shakespearean play, everybody in the class. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Email, you can use that, is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls for Rafe Esquith and Molly in Milwaukee. Hello, Molly.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a question. I'm going back to school to become a teacher in the next few years, and I was wondering what was one piece of advice that your guests would give me to prepare to be the best that I can be as a teacher.
Well, thank you for calling, and welcome to the profession.
Hmm.
Well, you've just summarized the beginning of the book. The beginning of my book is called Once Upon a Time and What You Do Your First Few Years. Here, I can't give you one piece. I'll give you a couple of pieces. One, recognize that you're going to have bad days, because no amount of preparation can prepare you to what goes wrong in a classroom. No matter how much time you put in and how much passion you put in, you're going to mess up, and kids are going to surprise you. But my other piece of advice is every time you can, watch good teachers. I still do it. I don't think you learn anything better than by going into a classroom of somebody who's really good at what they do and getting some of their ideas. Most of the good ideas that I have came from watching great teachers. I love great teaching. I love watching different styles and different masters. So observe, 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 and please remember, it's a long journey. And I wrote in the book, nobody is a great teacher in their second year. You might be a great second-year teacher, but please remember that it takes a long time. And we have a sign that hangs at the front of my classroom that's the title of my first book, There Are No Shortcuts. And that's not only true for the kids, it's true for the teachers. It's true for all of us to remember that true excellence takes years of practice. That's the advice I can give you. And the other thing is, please stay in touch with me. I'm easy to find on the net. I answer every teacher who writes to me.
I really do.
Rafe. So if you have any questions, please write to me, and I'm going to help you out all I can.
Oh, that's nice.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. You don't have rules in your classroom, but let's talk about what is in your classroom. Day one, you realize there aren't rules, but it's a code. Is it fair to say it's a code?
It is a code. And basically, I challenge the kids on the first day to examine their behavior. And, you know, we don't wash our hands in the bathroom because a sign says wash your hands in the bathroom. We start to understand that you wash your hands in the bathroom because it's the right thing to do. It's hygienic. It has nothing to do with a rule. I'm not quiet in a hospital because there's a sign that says be quiet. I'm aware that people are trying to heal. Doctors are trying to do their work. And the kids and I talk all the time that there's nothing wrong with screaming and being crazy. That's why there are playgrounds and there are beaches and there are public parks. And we start to think about the concept of time and space.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about the fact that, like, I teach 10-year-olds. And, you know, they talk about if they've got a 3 or 4-year-old brother who go crazy at inappropriate times. And we allow that because they're 3 and 4. But by the, you know, fifth grade, you're becoming a part of the world. And so rather than have simply rules that we follow, I try and teach the kids values that they internalize, that they so believe that if I have to leave the classroom, which I do sometimes, nothing changes because they're not working for me. Mm. They're working for themselves. Every substitute I've ever had, they fight to get into that room because it almost runs itself. It takes a long time and a lot of conversations to get the kids believing. But another beautiful thing about staying in a school for a long time is I have such a good reputation there among the community that now there's not much more selling to do. The kids are believers from the minute they walk in the door. It took a while to get there. You got to pay your dues. But it's a beautiful thing when kids behave because they really think they should, instead of some silly system you put together where they're going to be punished if they don't.
Yeah, that is a truly beautiful thing. That really is. Terry in Chicago. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Terry.
Hi, how's it going? I live in Chicago, and I'm going to college to be a teacher right now. I probably have one more year left. And I just wanted to know what you thought about what they're doing with the Chicago school system, how they're closing a lot of the schools that are underperforming and moving the kids into different schools.
Yeah.
And if you thought that was a good idea, or if they should instead focus more on the underperforming schools instead of closing them.
It's interesting you say that, because I'm speaking here tonight, and I know I'm going to get asked that question. And I'm going to be in St. Louis tomorrow night, where the situation is even worse. You know, here's what my point is. As I'm only speaking as the teacher point of view, because I know that the affluent communities are up in arms, you know, going, oh, my God, we can't have all these kids coming into our school, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, it's not the best situation. Of course, we should be examining why they're closing these schools and why the schools aren't functioning. What I try and do from my point of view is when I get kids put into my classroom, and this does happen, at times when it's not convenient for me or it overcrowds my classroom, as hard as it is for me, I try to stand in the shoes of those students. What's it like being 15 years old and being told your school no longer exists? You have to get on a bus. You've got to travel 20 miles to a neighborhood you've never seen and be with kids from a culture you don't know. I think it's harder on them than it is the teachers. And as a teacher, my job is to listen to that kid. How are you feeling today? What happened over the last year? What do you think about it? I'm glad you're here. And I know we're going to have some rough spots, but I'm here to help you. And I'm going to show you valuable information that you're going to be using to make your life better. And I hope you'll be able to come along with me for the journey. Clearly, it's better if we don't have to close these schools. Clearly, that is a desperate measure. But if it's happening, I still think we teachers have to stand in the shoes of the students and make their lives firm but loving. We got to make them understand, you're coming to my classroom. This is my expectation of you. Mm-hmm. And if you've had problems in the past, I'm sorry about that, but this is the reality. You're here now, and I'm going to do everything I can to be a good teacher to you. I think it's very important that these kids who are coming into new schools hear that message from their teachers, even when it's inconvenient.
Thank you, Terry, for your call. Christine in Madison. Hi, Christine.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Good. I'm just so enjoying the lilty voice and the enthusiasm. It is infectious and can totally relate. I've taught for 22 years. My dad taught for 33 years. And we literally passed the baton. So he retired, I was hired.
Oh.
And I have to say, I did my master's thesis on writing Animal Farm with my fourth and fifth graders into a play.
Oh.
What a great book. We read it every year.
Yes. Yo, kids love it, and they can handle it at a young age. What I want to say, though, is, you know, teaching is highly subjective, and when they try to apply scientific measures, like right now in Wisconsin, we're going to be dealing with Charlotte Danielson.
Yeah,
it's really not about that. I mean, in Wisconsin, we had a budget repair bill that was said about economics, but it really was about eliminating teachers and mainly public school teachers to keep us from electing another Democratic president. You know, I mean, so that the attacks on teaching and teachers are not about the teaching.
No, of course not.
It doesn't matter how good you say you are or how, it's really about that.
Well, that's why, I mean, I've stopped listening. You're exactly right. I never worry about what those people are saying. And every year they're going to say something different, whatever fits their agenda. But I always have to bring it back to those students. It's not their fault that the system's so broken. And that's why I always focus on them. And that's what steals my resolve. That's why I don't get down. Because those meetings and those people are so depressing. And they're never going to get it. I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years. And by the way, I'm glad your father's a teacher. My oldest son is a great teacher.
Oh,
I'm very
he?
Proud of him.
Wonderful. That's great. Thank you so much for your call. We have about 30 seconds left. Well, you've already inspired us, but give me another word of inspiration, Rafe.
I wanted to make a road trip, so get out to L.A., and when you're ever in Los Angeles, come visit Room 56, and we'll have a great day together.
Okay. That's great. And I love the fact that you respond to everybody. That's good. That's good.
I'm happy to do it. We're in this together.
All right. Thank you, Rafe, so much for being with us.
Thanks for the time.
Yeah, our pleasure. Rafe Esquith, you spell his last name E-S-Q-U-I-T-H. He is the author. You're familiar, I'm sure, with his first book, Teach Like Your Hair's on Fire, and his latest book, which is an important one for people who are in the teaching profession and for all of us who care about teachers, and that means everybody, Real Talk for Real Teachers, Advice for Teachers from Rookies to Veterans, No Retreat, No Surrender. He's been teaching at Hobart Elementary School in Los Angeles for the past almost 30 years, and he has won many, many awards for his work. He is the teacher who, he's a great writer, too. He's the teacher who gets all of his fifth grade students to do a full-length Shakespearean play. It's been the focus of a documentary, and his work has been highly acclaimed and has inspired so many teachers all over the country and all over China, for that matter. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this show, and thank you, everybody, for your terrific calls. We have more conversation coming up.